Welcome everyone to tonight's Citizens Climate University. It's a weekly webinar program of Citizens Climate Lobby that provides CCL supporters like you and I with access to in-depth training opportunities on topics relating to climate change and effective climate advocacy. I'm your host, Brett Cease, and tonight's topic will focus on the health impacts of climate change and burning fossil fuels. We're going to join medical doctors and CCL Health Action Team co-leaders Rob and Lori Byron for a webinar that will explore the health implications of Dr. Schindel's testimony, health and economic benefits of a 2 degrees Celsius climate policy, the research behind CCL's messaging highlighting that the Energy Innovation Act will improve health and save 4.5 million American lives over the next 50 years by reducing pollutions Americans breathe. Poor air quality is responsible for as many as 1 in 10 American deaths today, and it sickens thousands more. We know that increasing levels of greenhouse gas concentrations in our atmosphere bring about human health consequences, and tonight's training is going to explore that. First, though, if we've done our job well, we have the following 3 learning goals: the chance to review the main health impacts that climate change presents, the chance to highlight the many health benefits of addressing climate change, and the chance to make that connection, how a price on carbon is going to be key to driving that change. So to get us through tonight's presentation, we're going to be joined by 2 wonderful medical doctors. Doctors Robert and Lori Byron are both physicians, an internist and a pediatrician respectively. Both have worked for Indian Health Service on the Crow Indian Reservation for over 20 years. The Byrons now work full-time as climate advocates and very part-time in medicine. They founded and co-chair the Montana Health Professionals for a Healthy Climate and co-chair the CCL Health Action Team. We are so lucky to have them both with us tonight. Thank you all for being here, and I will pass it to you, Rob and Lori.
Working in a hospital in Haiti years before we became involved in climate work, Rob and I saw children that looked just like this little guy almost daily. The mothers brought them into clinic not knowing what was wrong. He looked a little chubby, and chubbiness was very unusual in Haiti. He has kwashiorkor, a severe form of protein malnutrition. There was so little protein in his blood that the fluid leaked out, and then he swelled up, giving him this chubby appearance. He didn't look anything like the normal starving child. His skin starts to break down. He's very susceptible to infection with a high mortality rate. We tried to save babies like this, but we saw many children die of this preventable condition. This was years ago, and back then we had no clue that the misfortune of the Haitian people would be dramatically worsened in a few years from climate change, that climate would have a large effect on their ability and ours to grow food and feed ourselves. We'll come back to this little guy shortly.
So tonight, what we'd like to cover, we'd like to do an overview of some of the health impacts of climate change, with a particular emphasis on fetal and maternal impacts and nutrition. And then we'll talk about the health benefits and air quality and climate change issues and kind of bring those together. And we'll leave plenty of time at the end for questions and answers. So since we're presenting a lot of data, we want to keep things focused though. And that is, keep in mind that the main thing that we need to get across to leaders, legislators, and others is that carbon pricing saves lives, and that an effective, equitable carbon price is an important, even a critical part of an overall climate package. So climate change health impacts, this is on a single slide, which is taken from the Lancet Countdown US brief in 2018. Lots of information here, and we're not gonna go into, all of these, but just to highlight across the top are some of what we call climate pressures, extremes of precipitation, rising sea levels, rising temperatures. And then in the middle, exactly how those pathways will manifest. More heat waves, more air pollution, and we'll talk about that a lot later. And then a variety of others, but particularly concerning our food supply and quality and population displacement. And then on the bottom, how these will impact individuals and families, heat stress and heat stroke, lung and cardiovascular disease, more infectious diseases, mental health diseases increase, and particularly concerning, and which we'll talk about a fair amount, is the adverse birth outcomes, both on mother and child. Briefly, because it's the number one weather-related killer in the United States, let's talk about heat. We expect to see more heat waves, longer heat waves, and it's pretty easy to keep in mind that, well, heat exhaustion or heat stroke, that makes sense. Dehydration makes sense when it's hotter. What's maybe more important is there are more heart attacks, more strokes, more suicides, more lung disease. There's even a question that increased temperatures will result in more diabetes. Now, people with diabetes are much more vulnerable to complications from climate change and heat, but it may even increase the prevalence of diabetes. And intentionally skipped over cognition or our thinking. As things get warmer, we don't think as well.
So there's been a lot of new research since we last did a CCU on climate and health. And one area of importance is maternal fetal health. Even before conception, research shows that air pollution affects fertility. There's been good research done on car exhaust pollution in the United Kingdom. Women that lived closer to traffic pollution had higher rates of infertility. In California, they looked at women living near coal-fired and oil-fired power plants. And then some of those plants were shuttered. After their closure, the infertility rates improved significantly, but women living near to the unshuttered power plants continued to have the same lower rates of infertility. Mother's exposure to heat affects our fetuses. Different studies have looked at different parts of the pregnancy or at heat waves for certain numbers of days, so it's kind of hard to compare the studies, but they've all found increases in preterm birth, stillbirth, and some birth defects. Heat is also associated with IUGR, or intrauterine growth restriction. These babies are born smaller than they should be for their gestational age. And this actually can affect babies for their whole life and put them at risk for a number of chronic diseases. For example, when you're born too small, all your organs are smaller, including your pancreas. Your pancreas has tiny clumps of cells throughout it called islets that produce insulin. And you have fewer of those than what the normal size baby does. And so you are actually more at risk your entire life of developing diabetes than the normal weight baby would have been. It turns out that fetuses are exquisitely sensitive to the dirty air breathed in by their moms. And this makes sense because we've known for a long time that smoking affected our fetuses. When moms breathe dirty air, and it can be from any source, from forest fires, from car exhaust, from coal-fired power plants, and even from dust, research indicates that they're more likely to deliver prematurely. It's estimated that about 16,000 babies a year, 3% of our preemies, are born because of air pollution. These babies are also more likely to die of sudden unexplained infant death, what we used to call crib death, or be born with IUGR. But it's not just the birth process that's affected. There's been dozens of good studies showing links between moms breathing dirty air and learning disabilities, lower IQ, autism, and attention deficit disorder. Again, research has looked at differing kinds of pollution like particulate matter or nitrogen dioxide or black carbon, and again, in different quantities and at different stages of pregnancy, but the trends have occurred in all the studies. There's also links with particulate matter breathed either by the mom or by the young child and increased risk of schizophrenia and autism. We mustn't forget the importance of climate change on nutrition, and adequate nutrition is one of the most important factors for good health. Malnutrition is a big problem, and it's of particular interest to pediatricians because children can't reach their potential without adequate nutrition. Currently, about 3 million children die of starvation every year, about a third of the pediatric deaths. And about 10% of Americans who are food insecure, although that increased to about 40% last year with COVID. Now, food insecurity doesn't sound too serious, but it actually is. There's been a lot of research that indicates if you're food insecure as a child, you are susceptible and have a higher risk of a number of chronic health conditions, such as asthma, obesity, and diabetes. There's a number of ways that climate change is affecting our ability to feed the world, so we'll briefly review a few of them. One is with warmth. With the increases we've already seen in warming, it's affecting the crop pests and pathogens. They're migrating towards the poles, what we call a poleward migration. So they're covering a larger swath of the earth. They live longer, they're less likely to winter kill, and they propagate more. And so they do more damage to crops. Grain productivity decreases for every warm day over about 84 degrees. Now we live in Montana, so we're kind of the northwest corner of the breadbasket of the United States. And yet we see a lot of days over 84 degrees. Carbon dioxide is a problem too. Now we all learned back in biology 101 that plants love carbon dioxide. They take CO2 and they make carbohydrates, which are carbon-based compounds. But that's a problem for food crops because researchers all over the world have studied over 100 different food crops and they found that this causes the plants to then contain less protein and less micronutrients. About a fourth of the world is already deficient in iron and zinc, and these crops now contain less of these substances. And that might not be an issue for you and I with good healthcare in America, but it's certainly an issue for people that don't have access to healthcare. And for people who are malnourished, to lower the amount of protein that they're getting in their minimal diet, it actually causes them to be more at risk for kwashiorkor, like you saw earlier with the higher mortality rate. The problems in our oceans also affect, So extreme weather and extreme precipitation and droughts also affect the ability to grow crops, and the saltwater intrusion affecting the coastal lands and aquifers. So the oceans is a problem too, because about for a fourth of the world, their primary source of food is from the ocean. So the oceans have absorbed about 90% of our extra heat that we've added to the atmosphere, and that's affecting the coral reefs. We've lost about half of our coral reefs in the last 30 years. There's other reasons that have caused coral reef decline, but heat is definitely one of them. And in fact, there's never been a coral reef bleaching until the last three decades. And this affects our fish supply because fish larvae like to live in the coral reefs. And about a fourth of the fish larvae in the entire oceans start out in the coral reefs. The oceans have also absorbed about a fourth of our excess carbon dioxide. So they are more acidic than they've been in 50 million years. And that harms the shelled animals. So when everything from zooplankton up to lobsters are during the stage of life that they're ready to lay down their shells, if it's too acidic, they can't do it. So I'm going to hand it back to Rob, and he will have a little more on health effects and then give you some promising endings.
Okay, before we talk about health effects, let's talk about air quality. We talk about air pollution a lot, and that's kind of a big subject. And it's a good idea to break it down into two different ways. One, the air pollution that causes climate change. And as we all know, that's primarily greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, nitrogen oxide, methane, CHCs, ozone, and others. And health impacts are mostly due to particulate matter and ground level ozone. Now, clearly there's some overlap in there. And yes, if you walk into a room with just CO2 in it, you're going to have health impacts. But primarily, there is a separation. And that's important when we talk about the health benefits and when we might expect some of those. The reason that ozone and particulate matter affect our health is, first of all, ground level ozone is not the ozone that has the hole in it above the Arctic and Antarctic. Ground level ozone is a result of ultraviolet or sunlight on other air pollution, like VOCs and nitrous oxide. And also particulate matter, I used to think of it as just dirt and a few other things that wouldn't hurt you, and probably couldn't have been further from the truth. Particulate matter, especially PM2.5, which is particulate matter that is less than 2.5 microns. Now, keep in mind that in normal human red blood cells, anywhere from 4 to 6 microns across. So it's extraordinarily small. But these are very biologically active particles. They include dirt and dust, but also acids, heavy metals, a variety of other things. What happens is these get into the body and set up systemic inflammation, which leads to more vascular disease, heart attacks, and strokes. And particularly concerning are the negative impacts on fetal and maternal health. Now, if you think about it, it's been shown that particulate matter is found on the fetal side of the placenta in a pregnant woman. Now think about that. Particles that the mom breathed in get all the way through the placenta and end up on the baby's side. I mean, that shouldn't happen, but it does. And also causes problems with pulmonary inflammation as well. Now, let's look at it from a different direction. People wonder, well, is our air quality better now than before? And the answer is absolutely. This is a graph taken from the American Lung Association's State of the Air 2020. It's a little bit busy, but particularly what you're looking at is the purple line at the bottom that's going down. That is aggregate emissions in the US. And since 1970, it has dropped dramatically, all because of the Clean Air Act. So yes, we've done better. The upper parts just show that during that same time, our gross domestic product has gone up, vehicle miles have gone up, population has gone up a modest amount, energy consumption has gone up some. But the bottom line is our air quality is better now than it was several decades ago. And that's great for what it is. Unfortunately, still in the United States, every year, air pollution contributes to anywhere from 68,000 to 250,000 premature deaths. And these are deaths that would not otherwise have occurred. Another way to look at it, and from a different study, showed that about 1 in 5 premature deaths worldwide is linked to the burning of fossil fuels. Now, that variation on that first one, 68,000 to 250,000, it deserves a little bit of attention. And that is, the first one, it was data from the Lancet Commission report in 2020. The second one is actually from Dr. Schindel's report, which we're going to talk about a little more. And you have to remember that these are deaths attributed to air pollution, but not because somebody puts on a death certificate, oh, this person died from air pollution. It's correlation studies, and they're very hard to do, thus the broad ranges, which depends on methodology. So let's look at the bright side of things. And this is also data from Dr. Drew Schindel in his testimony that he gave for the House Committee on Oversight and Reform in August of last year. This information is also soon be available in a study, which is still under peer review, but we do expect it to be published in the next month or two. But what Dr. Schindel and his group found was that over 50 years, policies put in place to meet the 2 degrees centigrade goal, or to prevent reaching 2 degrees, would prevent 4.5 million premature deaths over that 50 years, or average about 90,000 premature deaths a year, 3.5 million hospitalizations and emergency department visits, and 50,000 fewer pediatric asthma admissions. Now, thinking back to what we talked about with the air quality and things, is improved air quality, what we see is a lot of these impacts happen very quickly. For example, about 1.4 million fewer deaths in the next 20 years and another 40% reduction in air pollution mortality within a decade. It will take longer for us to see the impacts on climate change, but we will see the benefits on health very quickly. In fact, is everything we do to lower emissions and decrease air pollution improves human health. Sustainable agriculture is both healthier for people and the planet, and certainly has the potential to produce huge carbon sinks to clean the air, transitioning to renewable energy, improvement in public and shared transportation, or increasing walkability and bikeability in cities makes a big difference. Planting trees not only removes air pollution, but especially in cities, stores carbon, and improves our physical and mental health. We put it last for economic benefits because they're less important than human lives, but estimates are about 300 million fewer lost work days in the United States, a lot of that due to heat or lower heat, $700 billion per year in avoided health costs. And if we break that down a little more, a lot of that is because of the avoided deaths at what was estimated at $37 trillion, but also reduced hospitalizations and emergency visits, $37 billion, and improved labor productivity of about $75 billion. So these are some pretty phenomenal numbers. What can we do about it at this point in time? Well, one, if you're a health professional, then we would ask you to sign on to the climate and carbon price declaration as an individual. And this is on the CCL, the Business Climate Leaders website. If you're not a healthcare professional, then ask your provider, your physician, your nurse practitioner, whoever you see, get them to sign on or to get their system to sign on. And most importantly, keep the conversations going. We need to keep talking and talking to more to get this passed.
So thank you. Thank you so much, Dr. Lori and Dr. Rob. There's one final review of where you can find out more and get active with CCL's Health Action Team. On this slide, you'll see a step-by-step instructions from any one community. You would click on the top connect button, and then in the drop-down menu, click on that number two where it says Action Teams to go to the directory. And on that page, you'll see all of our directory of action teams organized by different sectors. The health team is there under the business and labor group. Click on the health team, and from there, you'll see the homepage of our health action team that Rob and Lori lead with the wonderful co-leader, Dr. Lisa Del Bono, who's also been so active in a lot of the efforts discussed tonight by Drs. Lori and Rob. If you click on that little join button, you'll be able to join the group. You can participate in their forums, ask questions, get connected to local MDs, nurses, health professionals in your community. One of the key areas that I think we can all do a better job of is getting networked and highlighting for local media, whether it's with LTEs and op-eds or even interviews on radio and television in our communities, getting this health professional perspective in front of the media and making the connections, any of them, that Dr. Lori and Dr. Rob have made tonight with our communities as trusted messengers. So please check out that Health Action Team option. And the other thing that they've mentioned here is the wonderful work that the business climate leaders, health and medical sector have done to really help organize and lend a collaborative voice for health professionals to sign on for significant policy. So you can see here, and all of these notes again are in the slides tonight linked to this training, where you can go and have your medical professionals sign up and specifically endorse carbon pricing principles or support the Energy Innovation Act. And so they are more than welcome to sign up in support for both of these policies. They're listed here. And we are so grateful for you leveraging your connections in your community to help amplify the voice and really strengthen how many doctors are in support of ambitious climate action like what we've talked about tonight. And for everyone that is interested in following up after tonight, here is both Dr. Rob and Dr. Lori's emails, as well as a link to the Health Action Team, where you can follow the dialogue, get connected with local physicians and MDs and medical professionals in your area, and also pose your questions. And again, I'm going to unmute everyone so that all of us can join in a huge round of applause for the Byrons, giving their time and their professional expertise on this essential intersection. So with that, thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Yes,
thank you. Keep up the good work, folks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.